Welcome back to Radio Rothbard. Joined, as always, is a man who was robbed of the title of Time Magazine Man of the Year, Ryan McMakin. The man who was recognized, Vladimir Zelensky, and a benefactor of the topic that we are going to discuss today. You have an article out noting on what has become an annual ritual, the Pentagon failing an audit. We will link to the article down below, but correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the fifth straight year in a row that the Pentagon has failed its annual audit. The budget for military spending continues to go up and up. Success is questionable. This ties into a side project that the Mises Institute has been doing for the last few months now. If you have not been watching America from Republic to Empire, that traces kind of within short animated video format the rise of America from a Republic of Liberty to a the empire we know and love today. Check that out, Mises.org/Republic to Empire. But Ryan, can you talk a little bit about what has come about this year and the Groundhog's Day of financial recklessness in the service of the military-industrial complex?
Well, as you say, it is a ritual that we go through, not just the audit issue, which is a fairly new ritual, but just this whole thing about military spending and the left. The Democrats pretend to be skeptical of military spending and then say, but we'll approve your spending, your new military spending that you want, Republicans, if you also increase welfare spending. And then the Republicans pretend that they'll block new spending if they don't get what they want on some related issue. And then in the end, the Pentagon gets a huge increase no matter what. And then a lot of the voters fall for it. And then we just do it again the next year. And then every year, federal spending just goes up and up and up. People fall for it again and again. So now what we've got is this added thing of the Pentagon audit, which I'm not even quite sure what the origin of that is. Obviously, it's progress, if for no other reason than to just point out that the Pentagon has no idea where its money goes. And this, of course, should have always been promoted alongside the whole audit the Fed thing. Audit the Pentagon should be a similar bumper sticker as to audit the Fed, and we should force them to really outline what they spend all their money on. Of course, a lot of it's also the details are kept secret a lot of the time, and you just have to trust us, and we investigated ourselves, and we're spending all of our money fine. But even with all the help and all the fact that no one's even really motivated, except for a small handful of people in Washington motivated to really see what the Pentagon's up to, they still can't even pass these things. And it's because their budget's huge, they're sprawling across 700 plus bases across the globe, they've got lots of secret stuff going on through the intelligence portions of the spending, and it's just a financial disaster. And it's not really going to affect anything, though. It's a little bit of good PR for highlighting just how basically criminal the Pentagon and its generals are in terms of stealing. I mean, because if they don't know where this money's going, where's it going? And what's the accountability? And I contrasted this with the private sector, right? What if you had a private sector organization that couldn't provide its stockholders with any sort of real rundown of where the money was going? Well, this would bring criminal charges. But when you're the Pentagon, when you're one of these generals, accountability is never something you have to deal with. And so we should just be prepared for more spending. Now, to throw some of the numbers out, they're pretty big numbers. And if you just kind of say, oh, it's a trillion here, a trillion there, the numbers don't really have much meaning. But just look at what, kind of in the larger context of federal spending. There, one trick that that people who want to promote their own interest groups often do, conservatives, what they'll say is, well, you know, just to keep increasing military spending because welfare spending gets increased more, as if that's somehow like an argument that the military is doing a great job and we should just keep increasing its spending. It's just sort of this, my team wants more military spending and your team wants more welfare spending, which isn't even true, right? Both teams are fine with it. The Republicans are not going to be cutting Social Security or Medicare. And of course, the left has no real interest in cutting defense to any appreciable extent. So both sides are actually fine with more spending, whether it's welfare, whether it's warfare. But they've tricked a lot of their followers, especially conservatives, into thinking that, well, we can't ever let welfare increase faster than defense for some moral reason. And so therefore, if welfare increases 1%, well, obviously defense should increase 2%. And look how much money goes to Social Security, welfare, all of that stuff. And so actually military spending isn't growing as a percentage of overall federal spending, and it should, so just keep spending. As if for some reason, I guess, North America becomes harder to defend militarily the larger the U.S. population gets or the larger the federal budget gets. So there's all sorts of these dumb red herrings that get thrown around about why military spending should be increasing. The reality, of course, is that military spending should be getting more efficient. It should be getting less reliant on troop-heavy deployments to defend actual North American and United States lands. But for some reason, that's just getting more expensive. Part of it is because the Pentagon just wants to constantly expand into the entire globe. So what we're looking at then is a huge inflation in spending from what was really more around $600 million several years ago to now. After Trump came in, he wanted huge spending increases. So then you're looking at $750 billion. And now we're looking at totals up over $800 billion. And it's important also to include not just the Department of Defense's spending, but also spending through the Energy Department that includes nuclear weapons. You could also include Homeland Security funds and then non-military civil defense funds. These are all, right, we're told, necessary for national defense. But it's also very important to include veteran spending, because veteran spending is nothing other than just deferred spending on military operations, because veteran spending is there to recruit, it's there to retain troops, it's there to promise troops things and benefits that they'll get in the future. And so it's really just salary spending that's pushed off into the future, medical care as well. And so to not include that in military spending is silly, especially since many other governments include that in their military spending as well for when you make comparisons. So once we look at that, at an all-time high for 2023 is the estimate, even in inflation-adjusted terms. So higher than the Cold War, higher than the old days of the surge in 2009, higher when there were wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which the Pentagon lost. And so it's a new high. There's no end in sight. Just keep spending forever seems to be what's going on right now. And it's especially easy when you can just keep printing money.
And again, this is after winding down in Afghanistan, right? So in theory, like, that should have been, you know, some sort of savings there. I know we left a lot of expensive material back there, but still, you know, whatever, that's a write-off. And correct me if I'm wrong, but these numbers do not factor in to the foreign aid assistance that Ukraine has received as well, which is, you know, tens and tens of billions of dollars in terms of foreign aid, right? So that's not even factored in.
Military aid.
But there's a lot of other aspects to, you know, our these supplemental budgets that we pass for the defense of Ukraine. So it's not as if, you know, this is simply ramping up for that side as well, that there's additional funds that aren't factored into our response to Putin with these numbers. And it's fascinating. And you're seeing, you know, it's from a political perspective as well, is that, you know, there's a variety of interesting transitions here. For one, it's how comfortable the Democratic Party has become in really adopting this global vision of America's proper place in the world. I know this is not particularly new per se, but I mean, the Democrats in many ways are out neoconning the old school Bush neocons. And I think there's some interesting, you know, additional cultural dynamics and things like that. Again, surprise, surprise, most of the neocons are now firmly on the left, where they probably always belong. For anyone interested in a conversation more upon kind of the Biden administration's readjustment of foreign policy priorities, I would recommend checking out Ryan's other podcast, War State and Economy, or War Economy and State, with Zachary Yost, where they covered this topic in an episode that just came out recently. But also, if you look down and you break down the political donations of defense contractors, which were historically always seen as more Republican favored, I believe even Sam Francis kind of identified back in the day that identifying potential economic benefactors to the right versus the progressive left, that kind of the Sun Belt, arms manufacturing might, was one of those institutions that benefited the right more than the left, that had consequences to political strength and things like that. Now it's becoming increasingly 50-50 on these donations. Groups like Raytheon have a significant Democrat-favored bias there. And of course, we get to see all of these companies light up every June for Pride Month, following some of the cultural dynamics there as well. But going forward to this next year, now that we're sitting within this lame duck calendar session, one of the big battles out there that is something of rare substance is the attempts by Republicans, particularly in the House, to add the barest additions to transparency on funding, particularly relative to Ukraine foreign aid. And the response to that is, well, we need to push a, $40 billion Ukraine bill within this lame duck session in order to kind of get us through a full year, right, to buy us time so that we don't have to have those crazies, right-wing extremists have this insane idea that perhaps we should have some sort of oversight in terms of how American dollars are being spent in Ukraine. Now, again, as our defense Pentagon audit indicates, oversight doesn't necessarily mean anything at all, right? So that's a secondary issue in terms of the actual follow through there. But the fact that that topic is as controversial as it is, and some of those crazies like Marjorie Taylor Greene that are interested in this issue, again, just goes to the degree to which we are utterly unserious about any sort of physical restraint on any of these sort of issues, where again, it wasn't that long ago where this used to have a little bit more traction here. And again, I don't know if the public is just completely apathetic to all of this, if the degree to which the disconnect between government spending and our wallet, it being so filtered through a price or money printing and the inflation financialization of it all. None of this, no one else is going to be talking about the Pentagon failing the fifth straight defense audit out there. And again, that is, if you needed an additional reason to be black-pilled about the current state of democratic discourse in the country, that might rank very high up there.
Well, it's certainly been falling in recent years, but the percentage of the public when polled that says it trusts military institutions is very high, and higher than most other institutions, right? Certainly higher than the media, higher than private business, higher than religious organizations, basically one of the most revered institutions, and people just let it do whatever it wants. And they even think then that it's a non-political institution, right? This goes back to those old technocrat myths about how the scientists who work for the government are non-political and they're just interested in the science, or that the technocrats at the Federal Reserve, they're just interested in sound economics, or the Supreme Court, they make decisions based on law and legal analysis, not on politics. People believe this about the high-ranking officers of the Pentagon, too. And you'll even hear that from a lot of old-timers who, when you point out that the Pentagon has lost all of these wars that the U.S. spent $2.5 trillion on, that's just at the initial phase. Interestingly, we're now looking at interest payments on the debt incurred for those wars to total about $6 trillion. So we're looking at $8 trillion, which is about half the entire output of the United States in a year. At least in recent, I guess it's gone up now because inflation increases GDP. But $8 trillion is a lot. A few years ago, your entire national GDP was around $16 trillion. And that's also about four times the entire national spending outlays just a few years ago before the massive increases under COVID. And so now it's about, double or 2.5 times the entire federal budget outlays. So that is a lot of money. And that's what we're just going to be spending on two lost wars. But in order to justify that, a lot of old timers will say, well, if they just let the generals fight the war, we would have won the war. This displays a couple of stupid ideas. One is the idea that wars aren't primarily political, that the only part of wars that matter is the tactical aspect that takes place on the battlefield, and that wars aren't there actually to win larger strategic issues. And so get a clue, read some Carl von Clausewitz, and learn that war isn't about the generals winning on the battlefield. There are much larger issues at stake here. And then second is the absurd and inane view that generals are non-political. Maybe these people don't even know that generals are appointed by politicians. They don't like work their way up through virtuous behavior on the battlefield. Now, maybe early in their careers, some of them might have. But once you reach the high levels, they become political appointees and they lobby heavily for that. And they ask their friends for favors and they want to get appointed to these positions as generals. And they work very, very closely with politicians to keep them happy and will say what the politicians want them to say. They don't have some sort of like independent principles that they follow. They're Washington actors. They're swamp creatures, to use more modern parlance. So we can all just stop pretending that everything the Pentagon does would be an amazing success if only you let the generals run it, which I guess we don't want the civilian government running foreign policy. Just let the generals do everything. It's an entirely idiotic position. But that's how a lot of the time the failures of the Pentagon are justified, is this idea that they're just these friendly, impartial people who just want to serve America, protect the Constitution, and win these wars. And so as long as those attitudes are out there, very difficult then to chip away at the amount of trust that is enjoyed by the military. Now, hopefully the military will go down the same road that the Supreme Court is going down, that the Fed is going down, where people realize it's a scam, that these are heavily politicized institutions, and that people on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, right, they spend most of their time worrying about how they can recruit more trans people to the military, so that, you know, every non-binary person has a chance to bomb a wedding somewhere in Afghanistan, because, you know, once you've done that, then you're a real American. And that seems to be their goal. It has nothing to do with responsibility toward the taxpayer, toward real defense. It's about expanding their own kingdoms and spending more federal money and basically screwing the taxpayer.
Well, given the current state of the priorities of the American government, it's only a matter of time before America tries to actively export certain practices that were very popular with our allies in Afghanistan and other countries. Is kind of where I can see our ideological agendas driving there right now. Hey guys, this is Tho Bishop with Radio Rothbard. I've got a special deal for you for this holiday season. Using the promo code Murray Christmas, that's M-U-R-R-A-Y Christmas, you can get 10% off of some of our great new apparel. We've got some great, a new Mises hoodie with a Tu Ne Se Malice on one of the sleeves. Looks great. A classic Rothbardian black and yellow. We also have some new Under Armour polo shirts in a variety of colors, including auburn, blue, and orange for those looking for a game day fit there. And then we also have some great Rothbard hats that code works for. So again, the promo code Murray Christmas, that will give you 10% off these great apparel items. Now, let's get back to the show. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting because on the right, there has, I think, been a recognition of, again, you see it popping up a little bit here and there. You know, being at the National Conservatism Conference earlier this year, I was really struck by, while there was, I think, a consistent theme that China should be the priority versus these past proxy wars, and in the Middle East and some of these other aspects, I was surprised by how there was still a level of appreciative restraint in the limitations of what pure military action can do. Now, part of that comes when you're going up against China. there are natural restraints that any sane person can recognize relative to, you know, going up against a bunch of people living in tents in Afghanistan. Now, again, the bar there of sanity disqualifies the majority of our foreign policy apparatus currently in power. But I'm interested to see the degree to which is there any opportunity, assuming we ever get a change in federal power, which given the recent debacle of the midterms might be a very well open question about, you know, whether the degree to which America faces the potential of being a one-party state at the federal level for a while. But should you ever get a change in party leadership, is there any possibility for a general change in ideology there? And again, you know, if you're looking at the way that this has played out, I think you can identify certain issues that have similar problems in terms of the overlap in monetary incentives, right? You know, again, I think COVID being the obvious one, and I think something that actually overlaps very well with kind of the war metaphor. I think climate change and energy policy might be another one. But you know, there are certain states that were able to create a intellectual edifice to defend going against the mainstream, all the acceptable opinions in DC and elsewhere. Again, obviously Florida being one of the top ones out there that were able to, again, resist the financial incentives that the very corrupt captured economic apparatuses, big tech, big pharma, et cetera, had, and able to implement very strong heterodox thinkers willing to put opposition into practice. Again, using the Florida example, the Surgeon General Joseph Latipo, who was a very interesting guy because he, very much like DeSantis, his resume was very typical elitist, right? You know, he came to Florida from Stanford. I believe he was also an Ivy League trained guy. He was black, which kind of made him stand out versus some of the others out there for other reasons. DeSantis himself, right? He has a military background, Harvard and Yale schools and things like that. And while, you know, one might assume someone from that sort of intellectual background would be very much within that realm of you know, acceptable opinion, though, you know, props to Tom Woods, the coiner of that term, from being very much from that same intellectual background. So it can be, you know, the dangers of oversimplifying people. They were able to both recognize the issues with the mainstream thought and act upon it in ways to really create some different dynamics. I'm interested to see, is there any possibility of that scaling upwards? And again, I really encourage people to check out the conversations that you have with Zach Yost, because one of the aspects that comes up with y'all's conversations is the degree to which, you know, when we think about foreign policy and alternatives to foreign policy, what's not good enough, unfortunately, is simply critiquing the blunders of American foreign policy of the past, but trying to recognize more systemic views on how international actors act in the ways to actually pivot in ways to create foreign policy that is going to be less destructive, less parasitic to American taxpayers. And these are sort of conversations that simply being anti-war for the sake of anti-war, which is very important, right? I'm not diminishing that. It's very important. But thinking about the ways to which intellectual institutions can end up guiding power to make a difference here, that's kind of a different skill set entirely. Daniel McCarthy does some very interesting work on this. Again, I'm interested to see the degree to which these sort of changing views, this growing distrust, Again, the more defense contractors donate to Democratic parties, the way that that can perhaps trickle down through some of these policy formation institutions, Heritage, it's worth pointing out, has taken a major pivot in their neocon background of late, which is going to be very interesting to see what impact, if at all, it ends up having on shaping the foreign policy of the Republican Party in the future. But that's the one dynamic where if we're trying to find any silver lining to this very depressing current state of American politics, the potential for some of these institutions to change the scales in the way that actual policy decision makers and institutions themselves can readjust the way that they frame this from the way that's become way too status quo, that's the one question I'm looking forward to. And again, I think some of these battles in the short term on, again, the bare minimum on transparency for Ukraine funding is part of that growing readjustment, perhaps, on the right.
Yeah, it'll require a change, an ideological change, because as long as people can be convinced to do anything in the name of anti-Chinese or anti-Russian, quote-unquote, defense, then they'll just accept whatever. And they'll also won't even be interested in the details. They'll just be told that this information's secret. Politics stops at the water's edge. We can't criticize our brave men and women who go out and they're fighting over there so that we don't have to fight here. It's all the usual bumper sticker slogans that people fall for. And now it's the anti-China thing. I think a lot of people are fairly wise to the idea that Russia doesn't actually, unless the U.S. Provokes them into some sort of nuclear war, that it's really China that even is the convincing boogeyman internationally. And so now you're even, and so what that means then is if it's necessary to defeat China or keep China from conquering the world or to subdue it as our international rival, then you have to just accept it. And we cannot risk freedom. We cannot risk laissez-faire because those things will not help destroy China. Perfect example right now is we're starting to see politicians of every type and even op-eds in the Wall Street Journal telling us that America needs to adopt central bank digital currencies in order to compete with China. The reason, right, it's a strategic issue. If China is successful with, allegedly, right, the argument is that if China is successful with its central bank digital currency, then it will replace the dollar as the global reserve currency, and that will weaken the U.S. strategically, and China will rule the world. So now what they're saying is, hey, Americans, if you don't want to be speaking Chinese in 10 years, because, of course, Xi Jinping will invade America and run America then, you have to sign on for a digital currency run by the U.S. government where they can control your purchases, see where you spend all your money, spy on you in every way, garnish your wages when you don't pay your taxes in a way that the federal government likes, and generally just control your checkbook directly, which is the great dream of how digital currencies will work, and of course, why the Chinese regime wants to do it. How is it being justified? Oh, if we don't do it, China will rule the world. I mean, this is no different from the sort of Cold War hysteria you got from both the left and the right back in the 50s and the 60s. You got to pay more taxes. You have to deal with the secrets, military secrets. The FBI needs to infiltrate domestic anti-war groups and spy on you because otherwise the commies will win. And just a repeat, rinse and repeat, except this time just replace Soviet Union with China this time, and freedom is too risky to tolerate. And I think a lot of people will fall for that. I think it'll only start to get some sort of resistance when people start to realize that this sort of defense spending and this obsession with being the global policeman is not costless. And that will only come when you start to really hit the limits of just printing money. Because as it is right now, hey, we'll just do anything. Just print more money. And basically all shackles on printing money just came off during the COVID thing. And I gave a talk at one of our events saying that, look, this isn't just like regular military spending, printing up $3 trillion. This is a new frontier. And it's actually very similar to what happened in World War II where the central bank was just monetizing debt so the U.S. could just keep spending forever with printed money on more military spending. That eventually had to come to an end because they realized that would lead to runaway inflation. You had very high inflation in the early 50s because of that. And then, of course, you had a high inflation again after the Vietnam War. And now, basically, since COVID was financially a lot like a war, you're now having similar problems there. The question is that how out of hand will it get? Will people make the connection between runaway spending and the problems of inflation falling economic growth rates, as well as the enrichment of the very rich at the expense of ordinary people? Those are the people who suffer the most under these easy money regimes. And only, I think, if people start to put two and two together on that, will there start to be some pushback on military spending. But that's not going to happen this year, and you're going to have some real economic hardship before people start demanding a change in military spending. And just these huge limitless goals for worldwide military action. So it's going to have to be both ideology and just reality is going to have to intervene in terms of economic hardship.
Well, and that dynamic too, I think that, you know, we can get so cynical and caught up in the insanity and hedonism of government policy that we can kind of lose perspective. But, you know, when we think about the excesses of the Cold War, like we were talking about this before we started recording, like, I mean, there was a time where the CIA and the Pentagon had to get extremely creative with the way that they financed anti-communist proxy wars and groups and things like that, right? I mean, the CIA was involved in selling heroin and, you know, cocaine and other, you know, black market items in order, missiles, right? I mean, to finance off the books various efforts, you know, around the globe, right? You know, there was some controversy about this when it came out, right? I mean, I could, you know, imagine someone in today's world, you know, getting caught up in like an Ollie North style scandal over financing the Azov Battalion in Ukraine, right? Like you can't even think about it. I mean, people would, you know, they would be on the cover. They would be the Time Magazine person of the year. Particularly if the president was Trump, right? If you had a government official that was undermining those Putin loyalist Republicans, you know, and finding a way to finance those brave freedom fighters in Ukraine that will always be grateful for our support, you know, they would be made out into the greatest resistance fighter of them all. And in 10 years, you know, Steven Spielberg, if he's still kicking, would be making a romantic film turning him into a patron saint of 21st century foreign policy. And yet now, though, you don't need to go through these hoops, right? Now it's whatever you want, you know, add an extra $5 billion and we'll throw it in. And again, like it's worth just always thinking that while this stuff has become so status quo, that this is relatively new, even with everything else that American society has, like this complete apathy to this level of spending is unusual. And again, this fuels into, again, just the depressing state of modern politics. It goes into, you know, Jeff Dice had an article last week about just how utterly unserious, you know, the entire concept of economics is, you know, from a government level. And it really does get to the point where I don't think that there is any way to politically steer and undermine the regime at this point, until we get to the harsh rails of economic reality. But again, you know, as we've talked about several times in the past, you know, America set up in a situation where we are going to be the last ones to feel the consequences of any of this. And more depressing still is that, you know, the degree to which it requires to get a Democratic voter base to care more about being poor than they do about, you know, electing a properly culturally progressive political figures or not electing someone that the media has told you is dumb, right? Which is the entire narrative, again, touching on the Herschel Walker runoff in Georgia. I'm not trying to argue that Herschel Walker is some brilliant, political savant. But anyone that thinks that Herschel Walker is unusually dumb for D.C. has a warped perception of D.C., right? And that includes the Senate.
Yes.
That includes the senatorial class that's there now, like which might have been different. And Jeff likes to talk about this. Like, that might have been different 20 years ago. But Herschel is no dumber than your average politician in D.C., far more professionally, personally acclaimed than that. But the media was able to so effectively spin the narrative that voting for Herschel is voting for a dumb guy that is beyond the pale. And so you have all these very intelligent, college-educated Republican Brian Kemp voters, voting for, a radical black liberation con man, wife-beating scumbag in Raphael Warnock, because that narrative, people are more concerned about doing the intelligent thing, the sensible thing, than their own self-interest. And that's where, what it takes to get to a population so controlled by these narratives to get there. Maybe the Twitter stuff ends up breaking through some of these narratives. Maybe the change in, and this won't surprise any Mises.org viewers, maybe the changes are the non-political institutions that end up informing the perception that we have of the state. I think the Mises Institute and our sort of content plays into that sort of narrative, so that's very important. But again, the degree to which that thing actually trickles through to the raw numbers of our wonderful system called democracy, it's going to be interesting to see how that time frame works.
Well, you have to admit that Warnock's glasses make him look very smart and intellectual, so he's got that on his side.
They should have been in the ring, though, together. That's Herschel. Herschel should have spent the entire campaign season, let's fight, bro. Like, that's where he failed right there.
But, yeah, just to wrap up with just building on what you're saying about what the Mises Institute does and the issues around the economic realities. Look, we're never going to get 90% of the population thinking in economic terms, right? What is all this government spending going to do to inflation rates and how will it affect the boom-bust cycle and all that? But you nevertheless need to build a sizable minority that understands these things. And that's going to be our challenge for the next few years coming up, is understanding the effects of government spending, right? That's something that we've covered many times. The right-wing critique of government spending has almost always just been on the taxation side, right? Is that the downside of government spending is when they tax you and they take your money away. Almost never talk about the problems with government spending in the sense that it drives up prices for raw materials, for gasoline, for labor, right? I mean, that's just the government sucks out of the real economy a lot of the brightest people. Because since they have access to limitless funds, they can just jack up wages. And this idea that government workers make less than the private sector, not true when you're talking about the highly technical stuff and the people who have master's degrees and PhDs and so on, or when they work for government contractors. Those people are highly paid. They're paid for by government money. And they're prevented from doing the more productive things in society because the military sucks them out and then drives up wages for the private sector that tries to compete with these highly paid, with these high military wages. And then also, if you look at the fact that almost half of the Pentagon budget, and not including the additional veteran stuff, but about half of that Pentagon budget is just going to these government contractors, is going to these weapons contractors. And of course, they're living high on the hog right now because so much of that money is going, so much of that money is coming to them so they can produce arms that go to Ukraine. I mean, basically, the faster you can crank out more weapons and arms, the faster you're just going to get paid for them because there's no limit on what the demand is right now. And they're trying to backfill the arsenals right now because they gave away so many anti-tank weapons and such to Ukraine. So that's just a cash cow right now in terms of government military contracting. So that's a huge interest group right there that's going to want to keep that gravy train going. And a lot of those people are actually Republicans, of course. So they're going to oppose any decline in military spending there. But our job at the Mises Institute and anyone who cares about actually really understanding how you're being exploited, how your life is being made worse by all these government money printing, by increases in spending, by these huge budgets, is understanding how it affects the boom-bust cycle, understanding how it affects inflation. If we get through the next economic crisis and the left succeeds in basically convincing everybody that, well, there was a crisis because there wasn't enough regulation. There was a crisis because the late-stage capitalism, quote-unquote, caused this problem. There was a crisis because of something China did. And that people come away without any better understanding about how actually there was a crisis because we endured more than a decade of just runaway easy money that the central bank facilitated, and then it caused a fake economy, a malinvestment-based economy that had to collapse at some point because you couldn't just keep printing money forever unless you wanted hyperinflation, that there's a chain of events there that was caused by a lack of enough freedom in the economy. There wasn't enough laissez-faire left in the economy to allow for the resilient sort of economic growth that we need. And it was ruined then by what's been going on since 2009 in terms of all of these asset purchases by the central bank, in terms of constant meddling, regulation, runaway government spending that distorts the economy. That's what causes the crash. That's what we've been trying to explain for years and years. But if you don't have at least some critical portion of the population that understands that, well, then the next crisis is just going to be, oh, well, we should have just printed more money. We should have just regulated the private sector more. We should have just trusted Bernie Sanders, and we wouldn't have had this problem. So that's what the fight is right now. And as long as you continue to think that military spending is costless, well, you're just part of the problem.
And if you're interested in more educational content, particularly on the topic of the growing warfare state in America's history within that, again, I encourage you to check out America from Republic to Empire at Mises.org/Republic to Empire. But it's going to piggyback off of Ryan's pitch there. And also, this is the holiday season, if you're interested in a wonderful book, perhaps particularly if you have a Republican parent, a Republican friend, someone who's trying to navigate the changes in the way that conservatives think about foreign policy, I would highly recommend the closest thing we have to a Rothbard autobiography, which is Betrayal of the American Right, that was published during the War on Terror years. I believe it was edited and has a foreword by Tom Woods, who can speak very well from that sort of conservative perspective. And so that's a great breakdown into just how did the American conservative movement become the great cheerleaders of endless military spending that we are now perhaps seeing a reversal to. And you can get a discount on Betrayal of the American Right using the promo code ROTHPOD. That's ROTHPOD out there. A great book for any Radio Rothbard listener. Well, now that I've gotten through all of the shameless shilling, Ryan, I think we'll call that an episode. For Ryan McMakin, this is Tho Bishop. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.